This is The Urban Connection, the weekly show on issues that affect the community.
Roughly 6% of American doctors are black, even as African Americans continue to struggle with a range of illnesses compared with whites. This week, we talk with a doctor who will explain why the lack of black physicians can be a bad thing for patients.
That's what you find out, that a lot of people in the black community don't have the basic preventive medicines because there's no one there to teach that to them. And so therefore, there's catastrophe. Patients die early of disease, they're preventable.
I'm Leonard Birdsong. The Urban Connection starts right after this.
Now, The Urban Connection continues. Once again, here's Leonard Birdsong.
Did you know that only about 4% of all U.S. physicians are black men? And that female black physicians make up only 2% of that number? The lack of black physicians is a big problem that adversely affects the healthcare outcomes of black patients who often mistrust physicians who don't look like them. Our guest today is Christopher H. Hall, Dr. Christopher H. Hall. He is an ER doctor, emergency room doctor in Mississippi, and he's going to talk to us about how the lack of black physicians harms patients. Dr. Hall, thank you for coming on The Urban Connection.
Thanks for inviting me back.
Now, I've talked to other doctors, and this is the first time that I have seen the statistics. I knew that there probably weren't more than 4% black physicians, but I didn't know there was only 2% women. But you say the lack of black doctors harm patients. Can you tell us some statistics and why this is true?
Right. If you look in the areas where there are a lot of actually black Americans concentrated in inner cities and rural areas, if you look at the physicians that work in those areas, what you'll see is that there actually are a number of physicians of color that work in those areas, and there are a number of black physicians. And so most black physicians work in those areas. And sometimes that's by choice of the doctors where they choose to work. And so if you increase that stream of physicians that are going in the area, that obviously will increase how much health care that can be done in the area. Now, this is the thing. You can therefore say if you don't have the doctors in the area to just do the basic stuff, the preventive medicine, so far as treating hypertension, that would stop things like heart attacks and strokes, the basic of treating diabetes, again, those stop heart attacks, strokes, and those things, then the rates of those things are going to be higher, strokes and heart. And that's what you find out, that a lot of people in the black community don't have the basic preventive medicines because there's no one there to teach that to them. And so therefore, they, you know, there's catastrophe. And patients die early of disease, they're preventable. So yeah, lack of black doctors in that area can cause greater problems.
All right, I understand that. So how do we get more black physicians in this country, do you think?
That's a very good question. Again, we've got a problem with really, I think, early on, kindergarten, I mean, through elementary school, okay? And then you've got to start early. And obviously, going to medical school, you have to have a strong interest in science. And so that's what we see in the public school system. We don't see a large number of black males, or females for that matter, in those classes, in those preparatory classes, things like chemistry, you know, general chemistry, physics, classes in biology. Those are the classes that are actually required to go into these health professional schools, like medical school or dental school or even optometry school. And so up until recently, were not even more than, say, 500 black males a year in the United States that would enroll in U.S. medical schools. Just in the last 2 years, that number has broken that barrier. And I think last year, if we look at the data, recent data from the AAMC, you'll see, I think there were 600 actual black Americans, males, who enrolled in the U.S. medical schools.
Now, what we want the listening public to know is that until probably the last 25 or 30 years, the only place black people could be doctors or go to medical school or Howard University and Meharry University. Isn't that right?
That's very true. That's very true.
Because those are the places that black people could go to be doctors. So you're saying that there are other schools now. Now, some of them, I know it myself. I know several doctors who graduated from Harvard Medical School, same time I graduated from Harvard Law School.
Right.
So I know that there are black doctors out there at other schools, but still I think Howard and Meharry turn out most of the African-American doctors. Isn't that right?
Yeah, there's still a large percentage of the black physicians are educated at Howard and Meharry. Again, the numbers are such that, and that number I told you, that number that 600, and now that I think about it, and you actually look at the, you look at the data at the AMC, you'll see that actually all of the 600 are not black Americans, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You have some of those students that are coming from, they may come from the Caribbean, or they may come from different parts of Africa, okay? But they end up in America. They're not U.S. citizens, but they're counted in that number of black enrollees, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So your typical number is something like, and the women, the black women, their numbers are typically greater than men starting into first-year classes of medical schools. I mean, women might have, say, maybe close to 1,000 women starting, you know, a year. Again, not all those women are black Americans. Again, a lot of those women are also from African countries, from maybe from Haiti. They may be from Trinidad, the Caribbean, but they're counted as the enrollees, okay? So actual black Americans, again, the number's not going to be 1,000, but overall, women, it may be something like 500, and the men maybe something more like 400.
Okay.
And the rest will be pretty much immigrants from African territories that are considered to be, that are considered black and are in that number.
Yeah, well, I understand that. You know, back in the 90s when I was in practice, when I had my own law firm, yeah, I did a lot of immigration work, and I represented a number of doctors from Africa who had gotten their education, their medical education, in Eastern Europe.
Exactly.
And I helped them get internships or work at the VA hospitals in the United States. And it was just very interesting that Africans would go leave Nigeria or Ghana and go to some place like Romania to become a doctor. But they do it. They did it. They learned the language and they passed the tests and they became medical doctors. And I got some of them here to the United States. But still, it's not enough of African Americans or, let's say, people of color who are doctors. Now, you know, I've seen in the last few years there doctors from Pakistan and places like that. These are generally drab brown people, but,
right,
you know, there's nothing wrong with that in my opinion. They're helping. The
right
doctors that I have right now, most of them were trained in Puerto Rico, and they're very, very good.
Yes,
they
sir
are better, in my opinion, than the white doctors that I've had over the years.
Understood.
But I'm proud of working with those doctors. I think they've helped me stay healthy as long as I have lived here. And, you know, I'll stay with them.
Right.
Probably because they come from a smaller place where color is not that big a deal, okay?
Right.
But they have white Puerto Ricans and brown Puerto Ricans, and just so happens the people I go to are brown Puerto Ricans. And I don't speak a lot of Spanish, but I know enough to get, you know, get by with them. Most of them speak much English, so we do pretty well.
Understood. But
this is a problem. But let me just stop here, Doctor. You know, you're talking about some interesting things. I want the listeners to know that you've been on my program before, and, you know, you've become, I would say, sort of an inspiration and a role model to younger African Americans. But,
you
know, your background is something unlikely, because you grew up with a father in jail, a mother who was an alcoholic, and a brother who was in prison.
Yes,
and who would suspect that you would live to become a medical doctor? I think it's great. I think it's almost unbelievable. You wrote a book called The Ward of the Court.
Yes,
because you lived with families. You didn't have your family to live with most of the time, but you still made it through school, through high school, through college, and through medical school, and by joining the military.
Yes, sir.
Tell us a little bit about all of that.
Yeah, no problem. Kind of what we're talking about, that pretty much lack of black physicians in the U.S., some of that actually motivated me to actually become a doctor. And in general, let me say this. There's a shortage of physicians physicians in this country in general.
Right.
And it's been that way since 1960. There's a shortage of about, every year, 16,000 physicians are short to treat the American public. And those physicians have to be recruited from somewhere. And so they come from foreign countries, okay? They come from places like India. They'll come from Africa.
Right.
And so it's been that way since 1960. There's been a shortage. And unfortunately, the shortage is getting worse. Now, more specifically, back to my situation, sure, growing up in the situation I did, again, boys' homes and foster homes, and again, I was the kind of rebellious kid. You know, I was probably a typical inner-city kid. I went to inner-city high school. And so, again, at those schools, you don't have all those classes that are offered to kids in more affluent areas, like the AP chemistry, the AP physics, AP biology, those things that would probably get you prepared for a medical school.
Now, you went to school in Los Angeles area, right?
Right. And it's the center of Los Angeles. I graduated from a school called Manual Arts High School, right there in the center of Los Angeles. And it was I would describe kind of a rough school. You know, there's big gates around it. It almost seems like it's a prison there. But you had gangs. You had those kind of things. And so, but what it comes down to is a lot of inner city schools don't have the required courses, you know, to really get these kids prepared for those tough scientific fields. Whether they want to become doctors or whether they want to become dentists or anything in the health professional field, or just scientists, okay? So that also contributes to the lack of black male doctors and black female doctors that we're producing in our society. But seeing that as a kid, that, you know, there was a lack of physicians, and then wanting in my heart, you know, just to help other people and to want to change the world and society, all that motivated me to say, hey, let me go into a profession where I can help people, again, where I'll be able to take care of myself, and where I can be a role model for younger people.
Right. You realize that you had a love for sciences, isn't that right? What grade were you in when that happened?
Yes, sir. You're totally correct. And so I first realized this really when I was, I think, this is probably in 10th grade.
Uh-huh.
And I think at that time I was taking it was a geometry class I think I was taking. And that's when I first noticed that, yeah, I had kind of a love for math. And the funny thing, the sad thing really is I had to fight as a 10th grader to get in an appropriate geometry class. They actually had me in a class that had geometry on it, but the teacher was teaching us arithmetic.
Oh, my gosh.
Fractions. Yes. I promise you. This is inner city high school. They were teaching arithmetic and fractions in addition in a class that said geometry. And so I think after the first 3 days, I went to my counselor and I said, no way. I said, I can't sit here and relearn arithmetic. Yes, I said, I have to take, you know, college admissions exams. I know that material is going to be on there and you're going to have to move me to another class. And so the counselor said, she said, okay, this is what we can do. She said, you're interested in computers. She said, well, we can put you in this teacher's class. He teaches computers, but he's also a math teacher. And then that'll be the reason why you're getting out of this other teacher's class. And I guess it was, you know, I guess it'd be offensive to the teacher or something. But anyway, yeah, I was moved. And they put me into a magnet geometry class where I went on to, you know, I made an A the whole year, first semester, second semester in that class. And see, the kids who were in that class who didn't move out, they were taught arithmetic for a semester, but on their transcript it said geometry.
Dr. Hall, hang on. We're going to take a quick break and return for more. Our guest is Christopher Hall, MD, and we're discussing the lack of black doctors in our nation's healthcare system and why it matters. We'll be back with more in a moment here on The Urban Connection.
More of The Urban Connection straight ahead. Stay tuned. Let's return to The Urban Connection. Once again, here's Leonard Birdsong.
We're back with Christopher Hall, MD, and we're talking about the shortage of black doctors in our nation's healthcare system and how that can be harmful to patients. Dr. Hall, it seems to me that people like you are needed to talk to potential medical students, encouraging them to take STEM classes, science, and so forth. You had a particular love of chemistry, right?
Yes. Well, see, that's the thing. With chemistry, I started off, you know, certainly math was my interest. And then when I went to college there at the California State University at Chico up in Northern California, which really found after taking trigonometry at that point, and then I took a chemistry class, introductory chemistry class, and decided, hey, I kind of like this. This is a little bit different. This is challenging. And if I could conquer this class, then I could probably do almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, eventually that led to years later into a master's in physical chemistry at some point years later. So chemistry did certainly sparked my interest, and that helped me out a whole lot.
Also, why don't you tell our listeners who may want to go to medical school, and I encourage people to go to medical school, tell them about the military, how that helped you become a doctor.
Yes, sir. Thanks for asking that, because, you know, it's a great way, first of all, to serve your country, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is prior to going to the military, if you want to go into as a physician, you have to apply for a scholarship. And you have to already be accepted to medical school to apply for a military scholarship. So first you have to be accepted to medical school. Once you have that acceptance letter, then you can talk. The military has programs where they will pay for every year, okay, your tuition and fees, and they will give you between $1,000 and $1,500 a month, every month, to pay for your living fees. And so in my case, where I went to school, the private school was very expensive, and so my scholarship came to close to like $200,000 because the tuition where I went to school was at about $30,000 a year that then you have to count in the living expenses. And so it's a great opportunity. Not only that, you get to train in great, strong internship and residency program. I trained myself at the William Beaumont Army Medical Center there in El Paso. I did an internship there in internal medicine. Great learning experience, and there's tons of patients. And so you also get to be a leader, okay? You're an officer. I was a captain. And so, again, you're a role model to your younger soldiers coming in, the enlisted. They're away from home. They don't have their parents. It's their first time in the military. And so when they see you and you're there, you encourage them and you give them guidance. And you know, over the years, when I was a captain, I mean, I basically gave a lot of direction to a lot of young people. And so I mean, it was a great experience to serve the country.
I'm sure it was. Did you serve overseas anytime?
Well, that's the thing. We had some missions. Not fully over there. At one point, had orders to Korea. And so, not long periods of time, no.
You got a story about, you're an emergency room doctor now. I don't know when this happened, but supposedly you say that you treated the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan sometime or other. Tell us about that.
You know what? That's very true. And this is how that happened. So I was working in this little town in Mississippi, okay? And I'm not going to name the town.
Okay.
But I was working there in the emergency room, and I had been working there for a number of years. And so a gentleman came in, and I had seen this gentleman for a number of years. He'd come into the ER. He actually seemed very pleasant, and I had no problems with him. I actually knew him by first name. And so let's say his name was John. So I said, "Hey, John, how's it going? How are you feeling today?" And he told me what was going on with him and told me his symptoms. And so I stepped outside the room. And so there was a police officer there, a local police officer, who I knew as well. And he said, "Hey, Dr. Hall." I said, "What?" He said, "You know, Mr. So-and-so there is the
Grand Wizard
here." "Yes, here in this town for the Klan." I said, "Really?" I said, "Well, my God, well, I would have never known because I've been treating this guy for years." "Yeah, I've been treating this guy coming in for years. And, you know, he's never said anything inappropriate or that make me think that." But I mean, this guy, the police officer, was a friend of mine, and he wouldn't lie about it, okay? And so I just thought that was interesting, because the funny thing is that this guy had a clinic doctor who was a good friend of mine, who was also a black physician, and had been treating this guy for years.
And he was white, of course, I'm sure, being the,
yeah, he was
the
white.
Grand
yeah,
Wizard
yeah, he was white.
Of the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah,
but you know, is it just that there were not enough white doctors that he could go to?
Well, you know what? That's a very good question. Well, I think my friend's a great doctor, so maybe he's just a better doctor than most. But in an ER situation, of course, you know, you don't always have a choice. When you go to an ER and there's a one doctor coverage, you either see that doctor or you don't see him.
Okay, stop.
Yeah.
Please explain to the listeners what an emergency room doctor does. That's what you are, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So tell us a little bit about what you do so we understand better.
No problem. So an emergency room physician, my job is basically to stabilize patients, okay? And we stabilize patients from a hemodynamic standpoint. In other words, if a patient stops breathing, then we will try to reverse that process. by inserting a tube into the trachea and possibly putting them on the ventilator and get them breathing. If the patient's heart should stop beating, then we want to reverse that process. We want to give the patient medications and get the heart into a situation where it may be fibrillating, and then we can shock the patient and get the heart back pumping. If a patient is bleeding, we want to stop the bleeding process and to therefore that the patient doesn't bleed out. And then we want to try to find out the reasons for these disease processes so we can transfer the patient to further treatment and definitive treatment. And so that's my main job. Now, of course, we see clinic patients in the emergency room, people who have things like coughs, colds, ear infections, skin infections, things like that, which are really clinic issues, but we do see patients like that as well.
I see. Now, you've been an ER doctor, emergency room doctor, for some time. Do you have a specialty? And if so, why do you continue with emergency work?
I trained in internal medicine and in family medicine, and I've been certified in what's called advanced trauma life support probably now for almost 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only ever worked in the emergency room, and a lot of it came initially from my training in the military.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got out, I really wanted to, you know, do something that I thought was exciting and that made logical sense to me. And so that's why I ended up staying in the emergency room and for years.
Well, I guess it agrees with you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I mean, I love the excitement and I love kind of immediate results. And so in the ER, results are usually pretty immediate.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
Either you save the patient or you don't. And so I like that kind of immediate response to treatment.
Have you ever treated victims of gunshots?
No doubt.
Gunshot wounds?
Exactly. That's a very good question because the emergency rooms vary in size. So the first question is, what size emergency rooms have you worked in? And so over the years, I've worked in emergency rooms that have been as small volume as maybe 15,000 a year patients to more than 50,000 a year.
Wow.
And so, yeah, no doubt. There's been multiple gunshot wound victims, and unfortunately, some of them have been kids. And I'll be frank with you. In most cases, I've certainly been able to save them.
Good.
Yeah, it is very sad when you see a young person who's been shot through the chest, 17 years old, and they're not breathing.
Mm.
That's very dramatic. And so, again, I look back on my experience as a kid, on what I saw when I grew up in those situations, the kind of environment I was in, again, boys' homes, foster homes, juvenile hall, the gang activity. And a lot of it, of these traumatic injuries to young people, you know, they're from gang activity. And that's what we see in the big cities, in Chicago and L.A., New York. And so, again, this is why we need more physicians of color, more black physicians in the inner cities to remedy this problem. And you're right, Leonard. People like myself need to be going around talking to young people, motivating them to get into medicine, and being examples. So I agree with you 100%.
But you've been doing some of that. Tell us about it.
Well, a lot of it is kind of years ago. So more recently, I've been just kind of tied up with work and with projects with dealing with the book. And so maybe through with the book, you know, I've been doing it, but it's been more on a national scene.
Okay.
And now there's a national radio show where we talk to young people every week.
Well, that's great.
About motivation, about things they need to get ahead.
Okay, well, I'm glad that you're doing that, and I'm glad that you come on the Urban Connection again. I'm sure we'll be talking to you in the future.
I certainly hope so.
Dr. Christopher H. Hall, M.D., I'm really impressed with you and your upbringing and what you got away from. Thank you so much for coming on the Urban Connection.
Thank you, Leonard. It's always a pleasure being on your show, and I look forward to being on again.
This is Leonard Birdsong, and we've been talking to Dr. Christopher H. Hall. He is a medical doctor, came up the hard way. However, he beat the odds, and he's now a medical doctor, ER, that is, emergency room specialist. We'll be back with you next week for more of the Urban Connection.
That wraps up this episode of the Urban Connection with your host, Leonard Birdsong, a production of Syndication Networks of Chicago. Thanks for listening, and join us next time for another edition of the Urban Connection.